You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastion.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
I'm training dogs for utility. I'm finding out all their strengths and weaknesses in each dog. Even if they don't get a prize one, or even so much as a prize, if I know what they're made of, it may be that they're just not good test dogs. There's lots of dogs out there like that. Test isn't all that is. It's not the only reason for breeding. It is a way to understand what the dog is.
You pound too hard and you will take away something from that dog. I did not want to take things away from these two dogs because they have futures beyond just a one-day test. They may not have passed, but that doesn't mean they were bad dogs. That means that there was just a crazy day going. And it was, you know, the emotions at the Invitational too, holy mackerel, the energy in the air. Even if you're not a competitor, you can feel it. And the dogs have to be feeling it times 10.
Well, hello. It's been a couple weeks since I published an episode. This podcast is not a paid gig. I do this for fun because I love hearing the stories and learning from my awesome guests. I have a family, critters, three jobs, one which has become quite a busy volunteer position, and now it's hunting season. So while I'd love to stay on schedule and get out an episode every Tuesday, it may not happen. Because if I get free time, I'd rather be hunting than sitting on my computer. And so last week, I did just that. Sage grouse has been a bucket list bird for me, and I was able to head east for the last 2 days of the season. As a graduate of the Montana Master Hunter Program, I was able to get access to some 16,000 acres of private land to roam beautiful sagebrush country. I'd done a decent amount of scouting and searching for all the right things, those green up areas everybody's recommending, and I put in 15 miles the first day with not much bird activity. I think I tried about three different additional areas with only 2 hours left of light, because just as I started to consider giving up for the day, I'd look at a new perspective area on Onyx and go give that a try. Then I decided to go set up camp next to one of my favorite watering holes, and I cleaned birds from the day. A bit tired and defeated the next morning, I took my time getting ready. With the best laid plans resulting in a fail from the previous day, I headed to an area just nearby my camp that I hadn't considered previously. About a quarter of a mile in, a large bird got up in the distance, and at first I thought it was a raptor, but once I saw that flight pattern, I figured it had to been a sage grouse. I'd never seen one before. I worked the dogs throughout the entire area thinking where it got up that there might be some more, and there wasn't. And so we went forward another, I would say, maybe half mile further, when all of a sudden both Angus and Stasha slammed on point, and about 10 sage grouse bursted from the ground. What an incredible scene of those large, truly amazing birds. No doubt my jaw was dropped to my gun stock while I was able to take a double, rewarding both Stasha and Angus for their efforts. Holding and cherishing those birds and having that epic hunt with two of my favorite dogs will be a day that I never forget. On my way back to the truck, I called my husband. I could hardly talk, and I must have been stuttering because he quickly asked if I was okay and if the dogs were okay. I was finally able to get it out and share with him what had just gone down. When he took a sigh of relief and said, "Wow, that's great, but by the tone of your voice, I thought one of the dogs had been bitten by a rattlesnake or something." To be able to make that phone call and have someone as excited as you are because they understand how determined you were and the amount of effort you put into it is really incredibly special. I hope each of you listening has a person like that that you're able to call and share that sort of experience with. And if you don't, please make me that person that you call, because I get it, and you deserve to have someone to share that excitement and those tears with. I donate 10% of the Patreon patron earnings to a conservation group quarterly, and so for the third quarter, that went to the Pheasants Forever Working Lands for Wildlife donation page, which directly supports the efforts and expands the amount of work that they can do with the Sage Grouse Initiative. So thank you, Patreon patrons, who are paying $5 per month to support this podcast and helping with conservation. I really do truly appreciate you. Also, both title sponsors of this podcast, Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells, are also big supporters of conservation and habitat organizations. Your dogs deserve the best nutrition, so feed them Purina Pro Plan. Stasha, my German wire hair pointer, is fueled with Pro Plan 3020, and Angus, the Bronco that never stops working, is fed Pro Plan Sensitive Skin and Stomach Formula. And you need ammo to hunt, so shoot Boss, non-tox that packs a punch. I've been shooting Boss 2 3/4 number 7 since season started, for everything, from Huns, Rough Grouse, Sharptail, and Sage Grouse. You can order Boss online, they're direct to consumer, and they ship right to your door. You can go to BossShotShells.com. Siren Shotguns. I had my go-to gun out there with me last week. Well, all season, really. The 20-gauge Siren Tempiolite. When you're walking 15 miles through sagebrush country, carrying that 5-pound shotgun, what felt like absolutely nothing. To have a shotgun that actually fits you really does make all the difference. Siren has the only full line of women's shotguns. Check them out at SirenUSA.com. Last week at our women's grouse camp, which was crazy awesome, by the way, 15 women, and every single one of them got into rough grouse. That just doesn't happen. Anyhow, the amazing Dr. Meg of On Point Veterinary Services came to camp and presented on field first aid, snake bites, how to remove your dog from traps. I mean, it really was an awesome presentation. But one surprising thing for me was to hear the amount of people that don't crate their dogs in their vehicles. The injuries that result from dogs roaming loose or even in a dog seatbelt, like dog seatbelts are a thing. When you get in a car accident, it's scary awful. Your dog needs and deserves to be in a crate to keep them and yourself safe during travel. I'm not talking about those cheap plastic or even wire ones that break and crush in accidents. Get one that will save your dog's life. I have had several different brands through the years, and I truly do recommend and love the Dakota 283 G3s. I can lift it in and out of the truck easily by myself, and other good kennels out there are pretty heavy, but they will also save your dog's life, but I like ones that I can go in and out by myself. The doors lock, so I don't need to worry about the dog that I leave in the truck while I'm out hunting with the other two. I always take three dogs hunting with me so that one gets a break. And not having those concerns that someone is going to come steal my dog out of the kennel is a really nice feeling to know. Keep them locked up. So, if you don't have a Dakota 283 crate, go get yourself one and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE to get 10% off. Today's guest is Bridget Nielsen. Bridget is a professional trainer for all versatile pointing breeds and is a breeder, owner, trainer, and handler of some of the top Vizslas in the country. She expects the Vizsla to have natural pointing instinct, a natural desire to retrieve, and a love of water. Bridget ran 3 dogs at the NAVDA Invitational a few weeks ago, and when she wasn't on the running order, she was volunteering her time and rooting on her fellow training partners and friends. Bridget truly exemplifies all that is good in the NAVDA organization. I encourage you to get the opportunity and talk dogs and hunting with Bridget. The passion and knowledge overfloweth with her. All right, now let's get after it. All right, welcome to the podcast, Bridget.
Thank you. Oh, it's great to join you, especially after coming off the Invitational and getting a couple days to recollect my feelings and thoughts.
Right. A couple days at that, like literally you just got back on what? Was it Saturday night?
Yep. We just pulled in Saturday night.
Okay. Are you a little bit exhausted coming off of that?
Oh, I won't lie. Yesterday was what I would like to call a zombie day. I, you know, got myself resettled, tried to recheck what I'm doing for the week, but really just was a zombie. The social atmosphere at the Invitational is so intense for 7 days. I was there, so I was tired when I came home.
Right. It's not just the social aspect. You ran 3 dogs this year. So you had a lot weighing on your shoulders with nerves, excitement, anxiety, all the feels, right? And then to add in everything else going on, that's a lot. What does the rest of your week look like?
This coming week, I'm back to training dogs, and we're working on puppies and trying to get folks' puppies ready for hunting season. We're very close to getting a lot of them ready to get out and go hunt sharptail and pheasants and all that. So it's fun. It's kind of nice to take a step back and work with the young dogs and let them be puppies and let them learn. It's fun. It's not as much training as it is learning for the pups, so it's fun.
Mm-hmm. How much longer will you be training until you head back to Montana and do some hunting yourself?
Oh, I'll be headed back in early October. My pups that I've got are almost ready to go home. We're shooting birds over them this week, so that's exciting. And I'm ready to get out and go chase wild birds. The weather changed when we pulled back into South Dakota, and it's raining today, and it feels good. It feels like fall, and I'm really excited about it.
It does. The colors are starting to change here, so it gets you in the mood even more, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. I'm ready. I'm ready to get out and just let my dogs do their job. It's so fun to let them just get out on the prairies and roll.
Right. So what does your hunting season look like once you get back to Montana in October?
Well, I'm going to run around Montana for a month, and then I'm going to do a little bit of fun hunting in Nevada and Idaho with a couple friends. A little trolling around out there, go find some chucker. Hopefully I'll have my fitness up enough to be able to hike the mountains of Idaho to go
right.
Chase chucker. And, you know, maybe come back to Montana, and if I can, if it's possible, get a deer. If it's not, then I will just keep chasing dogs for a while. And then when the snow falls and it gets super cold out in the eastern part of the state, I'll probably migrate south a little bit and maybe go hunt some ducks and then wrap it up for the season.
Nice. So when does your training season start for next year then?
Oh, we start up at the Force Fetch program around early February. And we'll take in dogs, getting them prepared for really the utility test or any of the advanced hunting that people want to do. Lots of times people come off of hunting season and they've discovered the weaknesses in their dogs. And lots of times it's retrieve. You know, either they get the bird and want to keep it for themselves, or they get the bird and don't bring it back to dad, or whatever it is. So we do a lot of training of literally train retrieve, you know, go get the bird, keep a hold of it, and bring it back to the owner. So we see quite a few dogs in the winter, and it's a good time to do it because the snow's flying and it's cold and you can't really be out.
Right. Can't be planting birds in the snowbanks.
Right. Well, you could try.
Right.
I've done it a couple times, but it's not with good results.
So tell us, you are a breeder of Vizslas. And
yep.
Tell us a little bit about your breeding program and, you know, with you being a trainer, how people can get some of your training work done.
So I became a breeder of Vizslas because, like many of us, I bought my first dog, and I was lucky enough to really stumble into this amazing animal that changed my life. I went from a hiker, biker, triathlete, and I was living in the Sierras at the time down near Reno, to getting this dog and him teaching me how to hunt and me how to learn how to train a dog. I realized how special he was when I started to get out and see other Vizslas. And then I jumped in full tilt and got a couple different females over the years and had a litter and, you know, didn't really get what I was looking for out of it. And I kept asking myself, why is that? And it really was through training and testing through the NAVSA system that helped me understand why I wasn't getting that first litter, why I wasn't getting the results I wanted off of it. And it really came down to understanding the breed first, but also the strengths and weaknesses and temperaments in dogs. And then for at least my breed, and I can't speak to all breeds for this, but I can speak to Vigilis, we really do not know if our dogs in this breed have enough grit to be the kind of hunting dog I'm looking for and be able to pass those genes unless we literally train them for the utility test and they are able to pass it. They don't have to get a prize one, but at least show enough determination to get through it. And really, when I'm looking at dogs for breeding potential, I really look at the duck search score. That's my most important facet in understanding what the dog's made of. And sometimes it comes down to training for duck search where, you know, sometimes the dogs aren't as keen on it because of training. But lots mm-hmm. of times if the dog has it, particularly in this breed, if they have it, you'll see a high duck search score. So it's a little bit of my barometer for how I decide which dogs I want to use. And really, it was a turning point when I'd moved to Montana in 2013. And I had probably 5-6 different Vigilis through my hands at that time. And I had a young female that she was a nice dog, but she was just not gritty. And I kept asking myself, why are you not doing what Mojo's doing? And Mojo is my second great dog that I had. And I stood on a hillside and turned to my hubby, Lauren, and asked this question: how do I get a female that can do what he just did? And he had just jumped out of the truck. We put the GPS on him. And before I knew it, I couldn't even get the gun out of the truck. He was at 500 yards on point. And he stood there waiting for us. And we ended up shooting. We were damn good shots. And we shot 4 huns off 1 covey rise. I got 2. He got 2. And Mo found all of them and brought them all to hand. And I had already trained retrieved him, but he proceeded to run that range the whole time, handled birds beautifully. And I wanted a female that could do that. And I just never stumbled into one. So I started doing my research. And that's how I built my breeding program, is looking for females that could do it. And, you know, and then really, like, I have a young puppy right now out of my own breeding program that her mother's a versatile champion, and then her dad's a UT1 out of my first litter that I had with Ripley. This little pup has a ton of talent packed in her, but I'll really get to find out what she is when I'm hunting in December and it's cold, and we'll see what kind of grit she's got. And that'll be a little bit of a determining factor. Is she going to move to the next step, which would be the train retrieve? Or is she going to maybe just go to a nice hunting home? I know it sounds hard, but as a breeder, I don't cut corners. I'm trying to find the dogs that are going to have the grit and pass on those genes in the future.
Right. Exactly. Is that the young bitch that was on your line that I met last week?
Yep. That was Betty.
Betty. Did you call her Betty Boop?
Yeah. Everybody called her Betty Boop, but yep, her name is Betty. Her registered name is Wall Canyon Hank's Blonde Ambition. And Hank is her dad and her mom is Blondie. So Betty Grable was a brunette and had blonde ambition. So she dyed her hair blonde. And so that's how we got Betty.
I like it. I like it a lot. With the Vigila breed, what are some of the strengths in the breed, which is the reason why you appreciate them so much as a personal gun dog?
My favorite thing about the breed is that they love to cover big country and ground, but at the same time, they'll stay emotionally connected to you at that distance. So you're not constantly yelling at them. You can have a Vigila at 700-800 yards and they still care about where you're at. Blondie is a great example of that. I've gone out with a lot of people who hunted behind her, and they will always say, my goodness, she covers ground, but she always just does a little glance over her shoulder to see where you're at, to move to the front. And she passes that on to her puppies. And I absolutely love that, because that's the kind of dog you can take chucker hunting. And, you know, chucker can see you coming from 100 miles away. They can hear you coming. You need every advantage possible to be able to catch up to them. And to have a dog that's willing to cover that ground, go up to the top of the mountain, hold point, you know, and wait for you. That's the cooperation in the breed, is really just a nice thing to have. And that's really what I love about the breed, that you can work with them that way. I'm not always, you know, I wasn't doing that with my short hair. My short hair made me always work to keep her with us and in range and working for us. She had a little bit more independence and really some days didn't care about where I was at.
Sure. So you feel like they have a nice balance between the independence and cooperation.
Yes. Yep. And I love the fact that most Vizslas, not all, but most Vizslas have some get up and go and take off, and they'll cover a lot of ground fast. I have seen some that won't, but that's just different dogs. You know, there's some breeding programs that aren't breeding for that. So
Do you prefer a dog? Like, cause I think of, you know, a lot of the Vizslas I've spent time with, you have the field trial lines, you have the show lines, you have the, I would say NAVDA, kind of a in between. And I mean, there's great dogs in all of those different venues, but do you feel like there's a decent amount of crossover, or is there a pretty definite split in the breed where you're seeing some things lack?
I think if you are looking at dogs on the extremes of whether it be the confirmation show ring or the extreme on the side of field trial, I think you'll have challenges there in some cases. I think just some of just different breeding programs that brings out what some of the stuff I see in the heavy duty big trout field trout dogs is a lack of retrieve. Strong point, easier to train on steadiness, but they're a little bit tougher on retrieve. You've got to do a lot more with them to get them to do what you're looking for. But on the flip side of that, you know, on the confirmation side, I see a lot of dogs that lack the interest even in some cases to even find a bird. And so there's a lot of people that are looking for that middle ground hunting dog that is going to get out and, you know, go hunting, hunt hard, but at the same time snuggle up on the couch. With all that said though, what's kind of interesting about the Vizsla breed is that there are some breeders out there that don't have all these titles. They don't do show versus field. They've had some solid hunting dogs that they've bred over the years, and you stumble into a dog with a pedigree that seems mysterious. And I ran one of those dogs at the Invitational. That particular dog has so much grit and so much, like, just we are hunting. He's just what you would call a keen dog. That's what the old school Vizsla had. If you go back, and we've lost some of those qualities. And it's what I love about him is he's got some of those qualities that you just can't. You got to look for them now. You're not finding them everywhere. I even went so far as to import a dog a couple of years ago to try and capture some of the bigger picture, fully rounded dog traits from Europe. And I got what I was looking for, except for he was a big boy. He turned out to be out of breed. So I had to make a hard decision. He's happily living with a hunter in Montana with his feet up on his couch. That dog had an off switch for in all my dogs. It was just a tremendous, just a switch in temperament. He could turn it off, lay on the couch and stay out of trouble. And then when you want to go hunting, he was like, well, let's go. That's what I'm trying to breed for, is that, you know, I want to snuggle, hang out, sit on the couch when we don't have to go running. And then when we go hunting, let's go.
Right. And so that's a good point there, because I mean, I think sometimes we get too caught up in the titles and in the pedigrees. And for those of us that just want to breed really good hunting dogs, we look at those titles as, well, it's proven here on paper, the dog can do the work. So that does hold some, you know, of what it is, what it's going to do. But like the dog you just mentioned, would you consider using that dog in a breeding program, in your personal breeding program, even though it wasn't necessarily from a breeder or a pedigree that stood out to you right away?
Yes, and the reason why is he has the traits that I want to pass on in the puppies I have in the future. And I'm looking at it from a trait standpoint, because I think a lot of breeders are so focused on pedigree, and I don't know how it is with other breeds, but I know at least for the Vizsla, we have an actual database that's open to the public, and you can go online and look up, I can't remember how many hundreds of thousands of dogs are on there, but the pedigrees are uploaded monthly. Every new puppy, that's being registered through AKC and NABDA is being uploaded into this database.
Nice.
And it's an impressive compilation of being able to go through pedigrees. So what's happening is, because it's open and free to the public, a lot of people are going on that. They find it through Facebook or whatever, and then they go on it, and they're hyper-focused on the pedigree side of things, and they're not looking at the bigger picture of the dogs. And I've looked definitely at pedigrees. That's how I bought my dogs. That's how I've selected what I want in my dogs. But also, I'm not hyper-focused on it. I'm looking at traits, and I'm willing to take chances here and there to be able to get those traits I'm looking for to pass it on. And I do believe that, you know, and I've had it in my first dog. You would call him a lost pedigree. But once I started researching his pedigree further, he's been gone for 12 years now, but that dog I bought in 2000, every time I put that pedigree in front of a breeder, they didn't know what it was. They had no idea where it came from. Now that we have that database, I can actually track him back to the original imports that came in the 1950s. Kind of fascinating. So that's how powerful a database is. It's a great informational tool, but it's also a little bit dangerous for the new puppy buyer, because you think you're looking at tremendous dogs just because you see all these titles in front of it. But at the end of the story is that there's some in there with hidden pedigrees that they're like hidden gems.
Right.
I guess that's what it is. There's a little gold mine that people don't even realize.
If you dig in there deep enough, you can find it.
Right. And then like the dog that I'm talking about, he did not pass at the Invitational this week. And I would love to say that was because of my fault. He had a moment of just literal, I'm not doing it for you today. And it cost him. And that was at the honor of the retrieve. He lost it at the honor. If he looked over his shoulder at his retrieving dog buddy and said, no, you're not getting it. I'm going to go get it for you. So, you know, and some dogs are super smart. And that if there's like a good thing about him is he's super smart. Bad thing about him is he's super smart.
Right. Good point. Good point. What is, we talked about some of the strengths in the breed. What is some of the weaknesses, or perhaps something that you look for when you breed to make sure that stud dog has done this and that there's, you know, a good line of dogs in that pedigree that have also completed that task? And you mentioned retrieves, but do you look for water love or good pointing? What are some of the weaknesses?
So the strengths of the breed that I'm seeing is we have an improved temperament. I'd say pointing usually not a problem. And then desire to run is not a problem. But there are weaknesses I'm seeing more and more is desire to retrieve and just carry things. I see it in some lines, and then it's completely gone in others. They have no interest in even picking up a bird. They will pick at it and leave it. And that's where I start to split hairs on, okay, that dog is not going to be considered. The other one for me is water. So I look at water love on a spectrum, and you have, you know, my very first Vizsla hated water, by the way. Got a prize one in utility, but the dog would do everything to avoid getting his toes wet. He hated water. But if you shot a duck and he saw the bird go down, his prey drive was so intense, he would go to get that.
Sure.
And it didn't bother him there. But when it came to just swimming for the fun of it, he would not do it. So there's a spectrum in which you see a lot of visuals. A lot of times you don't get that balance of, you know, it's a dog that hates water with an intense prey drive, because, you know, that's kind of rare. You're usually going to see a dog that hates water with a low prey drive is what I've seen.
Right.
In my experience. And so then those are dogs that will be very hard to train for, you know, particularly NABDA. They may not be hard to train for the field. They might do great in the uplands and be great little bird dogs that way, but they just may not love being a duck dog. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm kind of a nut about, I want my dogs to be water dogs. They want to be able to swim. Where I really start to look at that is when they hit about 7 months old. And if it's warm enough and they just hop in and swim, just go see what's on the other side. I know I've got a lot to work with there.
Right. How much do you use the dog's NABDA performance for your breeding program? Do you Do you take a lot of that into consideration?
It's the journey of which they're trained. The title at the end, so case in point, my one female is a prize, two female, and I was advised, smartly so, by one of the legends in dog breeding in NAVDA, is Bob Ferris. He sat me down and he said, quit chasing a prize one. I tested her three times in prize two, and she prize two three times. And he said, quit chasing that prize one. You know what she is. She's a nut about water. It shows on her scores. She's a complete nut about duck hunting. You know she's an intense dog. Her issue is trainability. Hmm. That's why you can't get a prize one. So make sure you breed her to a trainable dog. So he hit that right on the head, and the two litters I've gotten out of her, I've done exactly that, bred her to trainable dogs and come up with the nice mix of high prey drive, high water love, nuts for, you know, the big country, but at the same time, they are trainable. And that's the sweet spot you got to hit. Yeah. So, yeah, where I look at the performance in NAVDA, I want to see at least a utility attempt by somebody if they want to be to use their stud dog. And I would probably go hunting with them, to be honest with you, on that, just to see what this dog got under the hood, you know. Mm-hmm. When I'm training dogs for utility, I'm finding out all their strengths and weaknesses in each dog. And, you know, that even if they don't get a prize one, or even so much as a prize, if I know what they're made of, it may be that they're just not good test dog. Right. And there's lots of dogs out there like that. Test isn't all that. It's not the only reason for breeding. It is a way to understand what the dog is.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, I mean, would you advise against taking a utility one dog to a test like the Invitational? I mean, yes, that's what everybody strives for, is for that elite UT one. So you can get the invite, you can go to the big dance, but do you feel like there's a certain type of dog that just isn't cut out to run that test? Or do you think they can all be shaped to be successful at that test?
If you're looking at a dog that's two or three years old, which I took, I had three dogs under 4 years old at this Invitational.
Wow.
And when you look at a lot of the other competitors, there were a lot of people there with 5 and 6 year old dogs, seven,
mm-hmm.
A lot of 5, 6 year old dogs. And what I would advise anybody to do, especially with the Vizsla breed, take it slow, get the permanence of habit under their belt. If they get a UT1, and the way we're looking at it with our alliance that we're trying to build for the Vizsla, we're looking at utilities where it's at, and that's how we are going to be able to split hairs. If somebody takes their dog to the Invitational and they pass, that's just icing on the cake, but it's not where the breeding decisions are made. It's at the utility level, or at least if we're training dogs to that level and understanding what they are. And so we're not looking at just the Invitational is a great thing, but it's not what's making the decisions for breeding, or even saying what dog is better than another.
Right. And I would agree with something you said earlier too, with that duck search. I mean, I look at, when I'm looking at other dogs to breed to, it's great if they're a UT1, but if they've tested in utility 3 or 4 times and it's constantly that duck search that's keeping them from getting to that point, that's something I would not be interested anymore. Versus the dog that can go to a brand new test grounds, anywhere it goes, may have just had a bad day, it didn't pass, but that they can put on a 4 duck search absolutely anywhere every time they hit that water. But I look at the dog that we brought to the Invitational, who is that type of a dog, but the trainability, dog that's just constantly on his toes, on fire. I mean, he literally broke off his canine tooth the day of the test because he was so jacked up. It's a lot of dog to keen in on one day and get that obedience and that trainability down consistently.
You hit a really good point right there. And Tate Martinson and I, we're out training dogs this morning, and we're having what I like to call an after action review.
We took collectively, we together trained 7 dogs for that event, and we had collectively 3 pass and 4 fail. And a lot of people are like, wow, you got 3 to pass, you know, but we wanted more than that. Mm-hmm. But when I really soul search, and my owners that had the 2 visuals that they were so wonderful to give to me and allow me to train for this thing, because it's just a huge investment. And I feel so grateful to have had these dogs. One of the things I demand of myself, whether it be a UT trained dog I'm working on or whether it's an invitational dog, I demand that if that dog is, you know, like you're talking about, high drive, that they might push you on the obedience department. You try to work through that stuff, but there's, at least in my breed, you pound too hard and you will take away something from that dog. Mm-hmm. And I did not want to take things away from these 2 dogs because they have futures beyond just a 1-day test.
Right.
So they may not have passed, but that doesn't mean they were bad dogs. That means that there was just a crazy day going. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the emotions at the Invitational too, holy mackerel, the energy in the air. Even if you're not a competitor, you can feel it.
Right.
And the dogs have to be feeling it times 10. And Vizslas being such sensitive beings, and they're so attuned to their people, they feel it even more. I mean, it's not surprising to me that the 2 I had, they're both high-powered dogs with a lot of go and a lot of just let's go hammer down. I could just feel my own self. I'm like, I got to get myself calm, cool, and collected before I walk out with these guys, because I knew they're powerhouses. And I didn't, in training, I wasn't going to take something away from them. I wanted them to look good out there on birds. I want them to look good for their owners when they're out hunting. And kind of the most satisfying moment I've had all week, the one dog that I tested on Sunday who failed, he was on the prairies, the North Dakota prairie here on Wednesday and Thursday. And I got a video from his owners, and he pointed a covey of huns, looked good doing it. They walked up, they shot a double. He stayed till he was sent and retrieved both birds. That's right there, you know, when it all comes down, and they were so overjoyed. I mean, they're like, this is why we did it, you know, because he wasn't like that before on that journey. He was a wild man. And when he was younger, he probably would have, I guarantee you, he would have ripped that covey of huns waiting for his owner to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dog, he's a wildcat and he's got a lot of go. And it's the one thing I didn't want to do is take anything out of him. And you're absolutely right. Those high powered dogs, especially at a young age, it's hard to keep them bottled up and get them through that.
Mm-hmm. It is. And so let's talk about the dogs that you took to the Invitational. So you had the 3 Vizslas, and is that typical for you to take that many, or why did you decide 3 and why those dogs?
So my first Invitational was in 2019. I had qualified 2 or 3 other dogs prior, my own personal dogs, 4 dogs actually prior to that. And because I lived in the West and I didn't have the network, I never took them to the invite. I should have, but I never did. So, you know, fast forward, and Blondie was my first dog there. I went through it and she made it feel easy. She's one of those dogs that you were talking about. I can take to a new test grounds, new environment. She handles business every time, every time. She sailed through her NAVDA career like it was easy. And then my Ruby, she got her prize when she was 18 months old. And then COVID hit last year and she was put on the shelf because they canceled the invite.
Mm-hmm.
So she was definitely going to go. So then last year came around and we were training Goose and Driggs for utility. And we managed to pull off prize ones with both of them. And the owners were like, we want to go to the invite. I'm like, okay. So we talked about, no, Tate and I talked it over. We knew that Tate had 2 from the 2019 backlog, and then he qualified 2 more. And we actually had more dogs than that qualified for the Invitational for this year, but thank goodness it wasn't, not everybody wanted to go. Otherwise, I think we would have melted under the pressure. But At any rate, my two was my first time taking somebody else's dogs in there. And I won't lie, there was a lot of pressure. I felt a lot of, it wasn't from them. It was from me, my own pressure that I'm putting on myself to get it done. Yeah. We worked hard with them. They put in their best effort, but they had their moments, you know, and their moments got them.
Right. And this kind of a test, that this caliber, do you feel that is something that, you know, your first time bird dog owner would be able to manage themselves? Or do you think it'd be good for them to go watch an invitational, understand what it's all about? Or do you think sending them to a professional like yourself, who's been through it, can understand it's more than just what's required in the test? It's being able to use commands where you can. It's understanding the environment and what happens on that test day. What are your thoughts on that?
So if I look back on my first dog, I had enough chutzpah and confidence in him. I think I would have done it myself. And I just speak for myself. But then I look at, I don't know if you saw her post, but Megan Helmuth has a great story. She bought a dog 5 years ago, and she got her second dog when that dog was about two, I think.
Okay.
And the first time hunting dog trainer, and she qualified Bentley for the 2019 Invitational and took him in there. And unfortunately, the dog didn't pass that time. And he didn't pass. It was just splitting hairs on the blind retrieve. He went left when he was supposed to go right and didn't make it that. And I watched her disappointment in it, but she gathered herself up, had qualified her next dog and re-qualified Bentley. And here she was this year. She's 5 years into hunting dog ownership, 5 years. Mm-hmm. And the talent that she has as a dog trainer is just speaks volumes. She's doing this herself. She's got her mentors and her clubs and her breeders for helping her. But she's your great example of somebody who comes in and is able to at least be there. Her week wasn't as successful, and it was so close for her. Those two dogs put in beautiful performance, and Megan handled them beautifully, but the blind retrieve got both of them. Mm-hmm. And I was so proud of her, though, because she didn't have anybody else train her dog. And I think that's what makes NAVDA great, is there's so many people out there that can do this themselves and achieve these goals. To get a utility prize one, I know a lot of people strive for that for years, and they keep working with their dogs to do it. And it's wonderful to see the network that we build in these clubs with helping each other. I think the people asking us to do it on a professional level, yeah, there's some definite tricks you need to know. And I think it helps us get our dogs through. I won't lie. But at the flip side, the dogs still have to do it. And even good dogs have bad days. And I think that's the moral of the story there, is that we can train. But sometimes even good dogs have bad days.
Right.
And when I woke up Friday morning, I was helping out the test. And I walked in there and realized I'd seen the same faces for 5 days straight putting on that test. And the gratitude I felt for all the work that people put into that, it's what makes NAVDA great. It's so many people can do this themselves. They don't have to hire a professional. And there's a network of people there to support us to get it done. I love it. Mm-hmm. It makes me proud to have the member.
Right. And I mean, it was a massive event this year. And you had 2 years worth of qualified dogs. And I mean, for you as a participant running dogs, but you also volunteered, what is kind of your overall impression of the event this year?
As I walked into it, I was obviously focused on running my dogs. I got through those 2 days. And then when I spent 2 days volunteering, I was being field marshal, which it was kind of an easy job, actually, because I had great people there that were all part of the team making sure birds are planted and got dogs to the line and judges happy and all that. I would say that it was just amazing for me to see how many people had invested their personal time to either A, judge our dogs, or they were there to help put that event on. And the behind the scenes preparation to get this particular year put on had to be monumental. I can't imagine that people like Charles Coulter and Annie Noose and Angie Cohen are up and at this morning. They've got to be recuperating, right. I hope.
And Deb Stott, yeah.
Yeah, the constant. I mean, yes. They just did so much. And it, again, I felt a huge amount of just, this is an awesome organization of just great people. And really, my perspective on it was so different because it's not just getting a title. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want that. That's why we're there. That's why we train these dogs. We want a versatile champion on those dogs. But when you're there and you experience just all of the pieces of it and breathe in the dogs that are testing for the day versus the people that are helping out versus the support system behind the people who are testing, it makes me feel just so much pride. I was just gushing on Wednesday and Thursday. I couldn't believe how much had gone into this, and it made me feel so great. It just a lot of gratitude. I just couldn't thank people enough for helping me test my dogs.
Right. Right. It's an incredible community, isn't it? Just, and I think even the number of chapters all over the US and even in Canada, where when you sell a puppy, you know that as long as that owner gets involved in their local chapter, that they're going to be welcomed and they're going to be supported and set off on a good start, at least. And hopefully they enjoy it and they stay involved because it just betters your hunting experience overall.
Absolutely. And the other part of it is I always know when I'm selling a puppy to somebody who's going to come into the NAVDA game, even if all they're doing is natural ability, I know there's wherever they're at in the country, there's a network of people with a common goal to help them with their dog.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the benefits of being a volunteer, I think, you know, whether it's at your local chapter or at the Invitational, the amount you learn from doing that is immeasurable. My husband was gunning for a day, and you know, to speak on a lot of us, the fields you're in, you don't get to watch the dog's field work, which is always disappointing because, you know, we're there to watch these awesome dogs work, and then as the gallery, you have to just stay and wait and hear how it went. But some fields offered a view. But you know, it's that opportunity to go, all right, well, the dog failed and didn't get good scores there, but how did it run? How did it work? How did it scent? Or versus the dogs that did pass, but you know, maybe didn't get out and hunt more than a couple feet in front of them, more robotic-like. So to use that information in a breeding program is pretty valuable.
You know what I'm going to do coming up? I gun a lot, and I'm a pretty good shot, and they needed gunners at the Invitational, but I'm not a sanctioned gunner because I haven't gunned at a test yet.
Mm,
and
yeah.
So I'm going to gun at a test and have a senior judge sign me off because I want to be in the field. I want to help gun. I want to be part of that. I want to see how people are doing in the field because I think where people learn a lot is there's two places, planting birds. I'm talking purely the field part, planting mm-hmm. birds and knowing what dogs get them or not. And then the other part is being a gunner and being able to see firsthand what dogs are doing what. You can really learn a lot right there.
Absolutely.
I can't do that. I mean, I already judge, but I'm not qualified yet to be a invitational judge. It'll be a while before that happens. So,
okay.
But I feel, yeah, if there's any message I can pass to people who are just starting out in this game, or even if you're somewhere in the middle, when you go out and you run your dog, turn around and volunteer, because what you're going to learn volunteering is far greater than what you will even running that dog.
Even on training days, you know, you get your 20 minutes in the field sometimes, but if you go out and you plant birds and you walk along with, it's so nice to learn how dogs of different calibers, different personalities work out there and what they're doing to train that type of a dog, because you never know if your next dog is going to be more like that.
Well, like I said at the Invitational, a bunch of us were talking about it. If it was easy, we wouldn't do it. I mean, the reason why we're there is that you're trying to unlock the puzzles of each dog. And that's the fascinating part about the game.
Mm-hmm. What was it like emotionally for you? Was it a roller coaster throughout the three dogs, or did you, you went into it confidently you had three dogs fully prepared and ready for this test.
Absolutely. We walked in, Tate and I, and then we had our little training group that we'd been all working together. We all felt confident our dogs are ready. We knew where there were some hiccups potentially that might show up, but we did not feel like the dogs had been undertrained. They were, in fact, maybe in some cases, overprepared. Mm-hmm. So when you walk in, you're like, okay, we're going to do this. Now it comes down to handling, and can the dog keep the lid on? Can it think through the stress of the excitement? And my roller coaster part, I always, and anybody who knows me knows that I kind of go into my shell. They can tell I'm completely stressed out. And I go handle my dog, and I try to keep my emotions down. It is hard when it is the Olympics of the dog events, and that's what this is. And on Sunday, I ran Goose and Ruby. Ruby's my own dog, and I've hunted a lot with her, and I know her well. So out of all my dogs, she got the least amount of training too, because she, little Booger, went into season, a month before the test and had to be put in the kennel and not work because she was just a dingle butt. She couldn't get her stuff together in training because the hormones were raging through her head. So she didn't get close to 3 weeks of training. She sat. Mm-hmm. So she missed out on quite a bit. And so we're running all these dogs. My emotions were high. I went out with my first dog, Goose. He did the blind retrieve great. And then it was the honor retrieve that took him out. And I knew I was in trouble immediately too, because in training, he never gave us the opportunity to get after him about stuff. And he looked over his shoulder at the test and looked at that other dog. And I could see the look in his eye. I went, uh-oh. My command when I needed it, and he took it, and I prayed that he would hold the rest, and he didn't. He jumped at the wrong moment. And so it kind of, for him, as smart as he is, kind of took his day, and he went a little bit crazy. He didn't keep it together, and I don't know if that's just the excitement of the day. It could very well be. I do see a lot of dogs, you could tell that they can just smell it in the air. They don't even have to be near their owner. We all transmit anxiety down the leash. I definitely know that.
Right.
There's no way. I mean, some of them just go, oh my goodness, look at this. Look at pomp and circumstance. It's, oh, so exciting.
Well, and there's situations that you can't train for. And so the first thing of the day for our dog Rune was the double mark. And he went down there and we sent out, and the person at the Shortbird Winger Zinger had a pile of ducks laying out in front of her. So the dog brought the first duck back, and then my husband's like, okay. So he sent the dog back out in the water, and right away he turned around to go grab the second duck from her pile. And then the judges are finally like, okay, those ducks need to be in a cooler up on the hill. So they gave him a second run, but the dog was, he knew where the pile of ducks were, right? So he kept going over there. And, I think it's just an unfortunate situation, but of course it he was done for the day, but my husband was then just a wreck of nerves as well. And, upset. So that set the tone for the rest of the day, which was less than awesome. it's a stressful environment.
I think it's harder to have a day like my friend Megan did, where things are going so well and you get to the last event and it just goes wrong. Right. You're in the money for most of the day, and then all of a sudden you're at that last moment and it's make or break, and it doesn't work. There was a huge cheering squad for her, and we all cried with her. We cried with her.
because we knew that it was so close. I think it's actually harder to take that than the dog that mm-hmm. just says, I'm not doing this today.
Right. It's heartbreaking. It's absolutely heartbreaking. You just feel it for them.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was. Like you said, the emotional roller coaster. So you go into the day, you're trying to maintain, trying to keep yourself together. Then things start to go wrong. Then you really have to keep yourself together because you don't know how the judging is being judged. You don't know what the discussions are. Did the dog do it? Did the dog miss it by a hair? Did the dog get it by a hair? Mm-hmm. That's where you have to hold yourself together and go, we're going to go to the next event and we're going to keep it on the tracks. And you just keep pushing to stay on the tracks, whether the dog is in or out, because sometimes you don't know.
Right.
And that, I think the big lesson for me and for a lot of people that I talk to, I saw people coming out of the field going, oh, I don't know, I think I failed. No, and then they explain stuff and I'd be like, I don't know, I think you're on the bubble and you need to keep your head in the game. It was fascinating. We want perfection, I think, too. We know our dogs are fully capable. And that, I think, if there is any message I can give to anybody listening, is that you had 230 dogs show up to that event that were fully capable, trained, and had done all the things we asked them to do that day. They showed up. They all had done it before. We knew they were able. Can they do it on the day? That was the question. And a lot did and a lot didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess I haven't really sorted out or seen what the percentage was of pass versus fail this year. Do you know?
We were kind of doing it along each day. There was a good day. I think sending conditions changed and it went up to about a 42% pass rate.
Okay.
But it hovered in the 35-ish% pass rate throughout most of the week.
Hmm. Wow. Bridget, I'm curious, which bird species are you all going to be hunting this season? You mentioned Montana and then you said chucker, but like, is your, if I remember right, like, I think one of your favorite birds is sharptail, is it not?
It is. I love sharptail grouse. I love what they do for young dogs. I love hunting them. I love actually the late season birds because they're smart and they're coveyed up and they can outsmart you pretty fast. People think sharptail are kind of easy to hunt, but you get them in December and they become a very worthy quarry. And I just love the bird itself. I love being out there. Love their sounds when they get up. They, mm-hmm. they, to me, typify the fall hunting experience.
Mm-hmm. And give us a little bit of insight of how you know that the sharptail so well for the listeners that might not know.
Oh, so I started hunting sharptail on the west side of the Rockies and the Columbia sharptail grouse populations that were being recovered. Actually, they had reached that point that Idaho had decided that they were opening hunting season. And I started hunting them back in, I want to say 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a great species to be out hunting as a novice hunter, a novice shooter, you know, and a novice dog trainer too. The dogs can make mistakes on them and you'll still find some more opportunities to kill them. It's not like chucker where you only get two opportunities in one hunt after a 15-mile walk. And that's what I cut my teeth on was chucker hunting in Nevada. And, you know, I was tough, but there were some days it was like, this is no fun. I can't even get close to these birds. And, but sharptail are just great for particularly young dogs. And you can teach a lot of things with a young dog. And so that's why I really like being out with them. And I've hunted, you know, now I'm in Montana, mostly, you know, last 7 or 8 years. And I love seeing them do their lek dancing in the spring. And they're just a really kind of prehistoric, cool species. They're as cool as sage grouse, but in a different way.
Yeah.
I do, because they are kind of comedians. I actually was driving down the road when I was working as a federal biologist, I was driving down the road in Montana one spring and I saw these birds dancing on the road. And so I stopped and they jumped up on the hood of our white truck and danced on the hood of our truck
while we
sat there and watched. And they're just like a great little wind-up toy, and they're fun. They're just a fun species to pursue, but also just, I adore them. Mm-hmm. So that, and I
Hungarian Partridge because they are like little ghosts that they're there 1 minute and gone the next. So if you're not good, you're not going to catch them. And then I don't hunt sage grouse very often, maybe once every 4 or 5 years, mostly because they're good for a young pup, but I'm not real keen on trying to eat them. And so I just would rather them have their life and get to see them in the springtime. I like seeing them in the spring. And then I love charter hunting. I absolutely love it. As long as I'm in good enough shape to do it, I'm going to do it because it's about the hardest thing you can chase. And it will humble you. And you have to have good dogs, good shooting, and good health to be able to do it.
Right.
And that's why it's fun.
You're absolutely right. There's nothing worse than getting all, you know, hauling your ass up the mountain there, chasing them, getting into them, and then missing the shot.
Oh, yeah. You go to pull the gun. You're breathing so hard and your eyes are watering from the wind and then boom, boom, boom.
Right. Right. Last year, I mean, I only spent 1 weekend doing it, but you know, I was on a mountainside so steep that when I shot, I literally fell over. I'm like, this is not normal. These people are hardcore that choose to hunt this bird all season long. I mean, kudos to them, but wow.
Well, if you spend enough time in the West and you're trolling around little towns out by the mountains and you see guys get out of their truck, you can spot a strung out chucker hunter any day. And they are wiry. They can shoot like nobody's business. They usually have some of the best dogs you'll ever lay eyes on.
Right.
I've seen such high quality animals chucker hunting that they never get bred. There's somebody's dog they bought from some, you know, backyard or something. These dogs are just machines and the guys are machines and they're out every chance they get. That's hardcore. Those guys are hardcore.
Yeah. And you need a great dog to have, you know, strong feet, tough pads to be rugged enough to handle that. And absolutely. I completely agree.
And who doesn't love pheasant? Like, I'm going to chase pheasant for sure. I mean, we got to do that. That's always fun. But I always put my older dogs on the ground for that. The puppies don't get to hunt pheasants.
Okay.
I get into it a little bit, but I don't let them get into a pheasant field with all the birds getting up, especially early season. It just turns into a circus. And the old dogs, usually people are out to get shooting opportunities. You need trained dogs on the ground that know how to handle pheasants. And I usually, those are my dogs that I've already done utility with, and I know what I'm doing with them, and let's go get some pheasants now.
Right. So how are your older dogs, your completely broke dogs, your VC dogs handling pheasant? Are you allowing them to work running birds differently than you would with planted birds during training season?
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh, for sure. Yes. So like Blondie, who's a VC, but Ripley, who's my UT2. And then Ruby last year hunted pheasants a lot and she went to the Invitational this year. I got into some places last year. Our cover in Eastern Montana is a lot different than what traditional pheasant hunting cover is. A lot of people out in the central prairies hunt thick cover, and you're going to find them that way. It's a little bit different. And when I went to South Dakota for a visit last year to hunt pheasants, I found myself hunting differently than I do in Montana.
Explain
Ruby
that.
Ruby figured it. Yeah, it's a whole different thing. Like what Ruby learned in Montana was to run them out of the cattails, and you know, they can hear you coming from 100 miles away. So they're running out of the cattails and you push them up into the short grass and pin them in short grass. And I can't tell you how many birds I got that way last year, but that's because the dogs learned how to figure out how to push them that way. Mm-hmm. Then when we got into the thick cover, even with GPS collars and stuff, and, you know, when I chase them, I wouldn't get shooting opportunities because some of that stuff would be over the top of my head. And you try to shoot and it's just, you know, not that great of shots and I'm missing and that kind of stuff. So I like running them out of the thick cattails and into the thin grass.
What is your bucket list hunt? Is there a bird species that you'd really like to hunt that you haven't yet?
I want to go get some ptarmigan. I'm starting to think about Alaska.
Yeah. Yeah, that looks like a good time.
And blue quail. I've never hunted blue quail. I've done most of the quail species, mountain quail, California quail. Let's see, what else have I done? I want to call Montezuma's, but not Montezuma's quail. It's Murren's quail. And then not gotten is blue. I'd like to get some blue quail. Be fun. And I've done all the grouse species too. It'd be fun to, well, except for lesser prairie chicken.
Oh, okay.
That one's on my, but I would love to go get some time again. So I'm starting to think about when I can do that and fitting that into my life, sooner than later.
What's your favorite game bird recipe?
So I take pheasant and I just breast them out. And then I will put them between two pieces of plastic and pound it out to about a half inch thick, dredge it in mayonnaise. And then the Knorr Soup Company makes a French onion soup mix. And you mix that up with equal parts of breadcrumbs. I use Italian breadcrumbs, mix it all up. And then I coat them in that and I bake them at 350. That mayonnaise goes into the pheasant meat nicely to kind of counteract the lack of fat in a game bird. Mm-hmm. And then get a nice little crispy crust on it. Really good. They're great, especially if you do like a little stuffing with it or potatoes for dinner. Turns out really good. That's one of my favorites. I have other stuff. I still have yet to master sharp tail. I'm still working on that one. I've come up with a couple of kind of exotic recipes I've found that have been good but not great. But my best one was when we seared it in red wine. It was a fresh early season bird. Seared it in red wine and then did shallots and onions and garlic on it. And boy, that turned out good.
Okay.
Used it, you know, kind of put it in pasta. It was really, really good.
That does sound good. But I mean, I think wine and sharptail go together really well anyhow, but actually having it seared in there would be delicious.
But what I found that does not go with sharptail well is fruit.
Fruit.
And you see so. Yeah, people put a lot of recipes together with fruit, and I don't like the combination. And I don't know if it's just the sharptail I'm getting, but especially late season sharptail, I've been eating a lot of Russian olive. They get a little gamey, and you really got to treat them like you would treat duck almost. You can't overcook it. You got to be real careful. I barbecue a lot of sharptail too. I'll make Italian dressing and barbecue. It's really good that way too. Keep it simple. I see some people like Desiree Stormont, who I don't know if you see her Facebook page, but
yeah.
She's a master.
Is she?
Another guy. Oh boy. She knows the stuff she makes when the hunting season is going or later in the hunting season, she's using game birds or things that they've harvested. And I am so impressed. I still want to go have at Desiree's house.
Well, I'll have to get her on and get some cooking advice from her then on game birds.
Another person that seems to really put together some interesting stuff is Dean Aros, and he's in Canada and he runs Vigilas, and we've trained and tested and hunted together. Dean's got some tremendous recipes. He's got Hungarian lineage, and so he applies a lot of Hungarian recipes to these game birds, and wow, what. Like, wow,
oh, that's cool.
Dinner at Dean's house. It's cool.
That's very cool. I like trying new things. That would be fun.
Well, if you get out killing birds enough, it's easy to make a rough grouse taste good, but when you start getting into things like sharptail, well, you got to get creative.
Yeah. Well, and to be honest, I mean, I had sharptail for the first time last year, and it was one of my favorites, but you know, all we did was lightly sear it each side with butter and put a little salt and pepper. And, you know, you just get a little bit of flavoring on there, but it was very light. And man, I just thought it tasted like steak. And it's definitely, I mean, dusky grouse, blue grouse is a difficult one to beat on the tasteometer, but sharptail's right up there.
I'll have to try that. I've never tried it that simple. Maybe I will. That might be really good.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's just simple and you really get to take in all the bird. And I mean, I categorize myself as a pretty picky eater, but I think the lighter, the better. And yeah, I really enjoyed it.
an early season sharp-tailed grouse that's been gorging on crickets and chokecherry is very tasty. Those are very tasty.
That's good to know. Yeah, mine were just late season, but I will get out there next week because I'm on the pursuit of my first sage grouse. And once camp gets done this weekend, I'll have only 3 days to go get that sage grouse. So I'll get some sharp tail in there too. Hopefully.
Good deal. Good luck. That's a cool, it'll be a cool experience for you. The first one you get, because that first flush of the sage grouse, you'll kind of stand there with your mouth open because they're so big.
You know, I've heard that. And I just wonder if I'm going to go, whoa, what's that? And not shoot, which is okay too. If I can just at least see one, I would be more than fulfilled for sure.
Oh, they're a neat bird. I really treasure them. That's a cool thing. And my very first bird I ever shot was a sage grouse.
Really?
And the only one I've ever mounted, and I have on my wall. Yep.
Wow, that is awesome. Yeah, it's so weird. I'm like infatuated with this bird that I've only ever read about and heard about. And man, I'm just hope I can see one while Excellent. They're still available.
They're existing. Well, they're doing pretty good. They're doing pretty good. And when you're out there and you're enjoying that sage grouse experience, and if you run across one of the ranchers, don't forget to stop and thank them. Because if it weren't for the cattlemen, the range would not be there. And if the range would not be there, the habitat would not be there for sage grouse. So I throw that out there as head out into the fields to hunt. Our ranchers that are out there working those grounds, a lot of them, they love the sage grouse as much as we do. And if it wasn't for them, they wouldn't be there.
Thank you so much for adding that. You're absolutely right. You bet. Well, Bridget, thank you so much for joining me for an episode and sharing some insight and your experience at the Invitational. You were there all week and really were able to take it all in. So I was really excited to get your input on it all and with your breeding program and your breed. So thank you very, very much.
Thanks for inviting me and have a great hunting season.
You as well. Before we go, tell listeners where they can find you on social media, and if you have a website, how they can contact you for training advice or to get a puppy from you.
You can find me on Facebook at Bridget Nielsen, and I'm on Instagram at Wall Canyon Vigilas, and my website is wallcanyonkennels.com.
Perfect. So Bridget Nielsen, Wall Canyon Kennels. Put all that in there and you won't go wrong.
Thank you so much, Courtney.
You've just listened to another awesome episode of the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. If you ran a dog at the Invitational, pass or fail, you took the best dog home. And know that only 3% of the dogs registered in NAVDA participate in the Invitational. So be proud of how far you and your dog have come, because there's nothing quite like the bond that came from that journey together. Now go out and have a kick-ass hunting season. But also, be sure to check out the sponsors and partners of this podcast for all of your bird, dog, and hunting needs. Purina Pro Plan, Boss Shot Shells, Siren Shotguns, and Dakota 283. If you're loving this podcast and want to support it, get additional discounts and content, go to patreon.com/thebirddogbabe to sign up. And please support the conservation organizations of the birds they are chasing after this season and the public lands in which you hunt.